It's my privilege to introduce somebody to us that's well known, I think, especially to some of the older people, but I think all the young people. Gary is a role model to so many of us. And some of you know that Gary played for South Africa cricket for many years, and then he went on to coach the Indian team to World Cup glory. And later on, he also coached the South African team. But more than that, he's just his Christian witness and the role model that he is to actually say, look, yeah, I've gone to that place of great success and decided to put his family and other people first. That's really that inspires us so much about you, his wife Debbie, and they've got three children. And it's just such a privilege to hear your testimony, your story this morning. So we're just opening up our hearts for you and to share with you. But thank you for being that role model. We honor you, we bless you, and just for setting the example for so many of us. You know, all of us, we run many times, even in the church, after success, but God wants us to be significant, wants us to walk in that place where we leave a spiritual legacy. So let's put our hands together for Gary Kirsten, and he's going to share with us.
Thanks, C.S., for that introduction. Certainly great to be back in Stellenbosch, and as you mentioned, maybe known to the older people. That makes me quite old, eh? Didn't think I was that bad, but we are moving on, nearly 50, believe it or not. But it's great to be here. You know, I've got fond memories of Stellenbosch, some good, some bad, but generally fond memories. And I kind of divide my visits to Stellenbosch in two distinct periods in my life. There was that period from the age of about 6 or 7 through to about 21, 22, and then from 22 through to now 47. And the first period from 6 to 22 are my schooling years and my university years. And I would come to Stellenbosch kind of once or twice every Saturday morning and get a thorough beating from the schools here in that sport they call rugby over here, which is quite a popular sport, and then move back into the southern suburbs of Cape Town. And then I'd come here as a university student out of UCT and play Marties in an intervarsity and get a thorough beating and then head back out there. So that, whilst they were good fun actually after the event, not so much during the event. And then my second kind of period of coming here is to enjoy all the wine farms we've got out here. Love coming out here. So not that often, but it's kind of great to be sharing with you. We've used a word already this morning called expectation. And for me, that's been a very distinctive and relevant word in my life, because I think I've lived a lot of my life meeting the needs of other people's and my own expectations. I was just thinking about it the other day. You know, we, in the world of sport, which I'm sure many of us follow and enjoy, every weekend we kind of get our fix of the result of professional sport that's out there. But with that result comes massive expectation. And as a professional athlete for 17 years of my life and then into kind of professional coaching for another 11 years, I've had to kind of understand and live with that expectation just in the world of sport pretty much every day. And it's a weird place. Now, if I think of the young 8-year-old or 9-year-old who's starting out his sporting career at one of the schools here in Stellenbosch or anywhere in the world, to be honest with you, and he begins that career and he shows some promise as a rugby player or a cricket player or a soccer player, I think of all the stakeholders around that individual and his performance. Kind of who's expecting him to do well? And when I thought about it, I thought, well, he'll put some pressure on himself to do well because he's been taught that he's got talent and that he must pursue it and do well in it. So there's expectation from himself. There's probably expectation from his parents for a number of reasons. The expectation is the parents want him to do well because they've invested in him emotionally, invested in his life. And they might want him to do well because they didn't do so well as sportsmen and would like to know that their son is very good. Then there's an expectation from the school because the school kind of is becoming recognized as a strong sporting school, and they want that team to do well, whether it's the first team or the under 13As or whatever. There's an expectation from them. Then there's an expectation from the coach, because he wants to be recognized as a good coach. So he needs the performance from those schoolboys to go out there and to be recognized as the coach. We could go on, actually. There are lots of kind of expectations from different people. And what that is, it's really pressure. And I think we live a life at the moment where we are under pressure every single day to meet our own needs and to meet the needs of other people. And I think my experience and kind of my story, which I'm going to share with you now, is a story of I actually didn't need to meet those needs and those expectations of myself and other people. I actually found it another way that I could live a significant and fulfilling life without having to kind of always be the right person for everyone and be the right person for myself. Because I found more often than not that I was failing in that. That I was actually going kind of backwards every time I put myself into that situation where I needed to make the performance. I found that I was failing more than I was succeeding. And every time I failed, I kind of took another hit as a human being because I thought, geez, I can't manage this myself. I'm not strong enough to deal with this. So I took another hit. And eventually I woke up one day to the realization that it's actually not about that. That you actually can live a significant and purposeful life outside of your own expectations and those of others. So what I wanted to share with you, if you'd permit me just for a short period of time, is I guess a story for me that transformed my life. And hopefully there's some learning out of it. There might not be, but then at least we've had kind of half an hour just listening to a story. So I'm not coming here with any expectation, I can show you. But I divide kind of my time in my life, 47 years of age, into four distinct periods, from when I was born to about the age of 13, which was the first period. That was through junior school. And for me, I'd heard about God, and I enjoyed the connections I had with other Christians at the school that I was at, which was Rondebosch Boys Junior School. In fact, we had a little Bible study group as a bunch of 12 and 13-year-olds, which I used to attend. And I think at that point, I was influenced in many ways by my peers and I suppose my parents. We used to go to Sunday school, which I found utterly boring, but we'd go anyway. Then in this kind of second phase of my life, which was between the ages of 14 and 28, I completely turned away from God and kind of rebelled and kind of, I got angry with God that I felt as a youngster that I needed him to make a play in life. So I went out and made my own plays. And I went out and kind of mapped out this living that I thought was the right way to live. And I realized I needed to be successful in my career. And as a university student, I wasn't kind of sure what direction I was going. And then I found some direction in my sport. And I became a professional cricketer. And I kind of started to do well in the sport. And I was working it out, so I thought. And it was kind of going nicely for a number of years. And I was making runs and I was being successful, and then I'd have some failure as well, but it was okay. I was just kind of moving in this professional sporting career. I was influenced largely by my peers then, so I would move kind of with the flow of my peers, some good and some bad. One of the closest people that were to me at that time was John T. Rhodes, who was a very strong Christian influence in my life as I began my time with the Proteas. And I kind of moved with the way everyone moved within the team. And then a third phase in my life, which was between the age of 28 and 32, I began to rebuild my connection with God and find kind of what I think my life's real purpose was. And I'm going to tell you a story around that which really transformed it for me. I think during that time I was influenced by a girl that became my girlfriend then, way back in 1996, and is now my wife. We've been married for 16 years. And she had an incredible influence in my life. In fact, probably my strongest mentor. And it was through her and watching her example, it kind of made me realize, where am I heading and what direction am I going? And I think the influence that I had from her and her Christian friends kind of rebuilt my connection with God that I thought I always had as a youngster, but decided through my own choices not to move in that direction. And then the fourth part of my journey, which would have been from the age of 32 to my age now, 47, has really been for me the beginning of my new Christian journey. Kind of humbling myself to God's word and wisdom and searching for my purpose and significance. And it's been an incredible journey over the last 15 years. But I think for me it's been a kind of a growth period. And I never get there. I'm never at that destination. Every day I'm always learning something new. Some days I take two steps backwards where for some reason I'm angry about something. And then other days I take two steps forward. And hopefully more forward than backward. But I wanted to share with you a story that really turned for me my situation in my life. As I kind of went through this phase where I learned to intensely dislike Christians. For me, they represented something I was too strong to need. I think at that stage, almost unconsciously, I was persecuting and ridiculing Christians as I went through this professional sporting journey. I felt that moving into that Christian space where I knew I wanted to go, but never had the courage to go there, I would lose all my street cred if I joined the Christians. I kind of purposely stayed away. Consciously stayed away. I was too scared to go there. And as God would only have it, it was during a significant time in my sporting career, certainly my cricket career. I'd been playing for the Proteas for 5 years, and I was getting no runs. And England won tour. It was 1999-2000 season. And I was really battling at that point in my cricket career. Kind of not liking life that much because my success was determined about whether I scored runs or not and whether the Proteas won. And if we didn't, and if I didn't score runs, I viewed myself and my life as a failure. I was only governed by that result. That was the only thing that meant anything to me at that point in time as a kind of 26, 27-year-old. And England were on tour, yeah, and we had played two test matches against them, and I'd got a total of 25 runs in two test matches, four innings. And I'll never forget waking up most mornings and looking on the back page of the Cape Times, and there would be some headline with my name on it saying, it's time to get rid of this old man, Gary Kirsten, and it's time to kind of move on with someone new. He's done. He's finished. I'll never forget going to that second test match in PE, and it was the end of the game. I'd got six in the first innings and, I don't know, 10 in the second innings. And we finished the test match, and the ball gets hit to me on the last ball of the test match. It was a drawn test match, and the ball gets hit to me. And I remember saying to myself, keep this ball, because this is the last test match you're ever going to play. I'd already played 60 tests for South Africa. This is the last test you'll play. You'll never get picked for the next test. Keep the ball. I remember shaking hands with English guys and walking off the field and kind of being okay with it. You know, I was just, time's up. I must move on and do something else with my life. And I go home the next day. I say to Debs, I think that'll be it. And the next test match was in Durban on the 26th of December. This was about the 19th, 20th of December. And we had a chance to get down to Kenton-on-Sea, which is a family holiday destination for Debs's family. And I said, well, let me come with you because I'm not going to get selected and I'll have some decent time. We went down there. We'd been there 2 days, and the team was then announced in the press for the third test. And my name was in it. And I went, oh, no. I don't want to go back there. I don't want to go play that next test match. I've had enough. I want to get out of this pressure cooker. I want to get out of this kind of meeting the needs and the expectations of others. I want to get out of the fire. I want to move on and do something else in my life. And I was with Debs's dad at the time, who was also on holiday, and he's an evangelist. And he was, when the kind of team was announced, he was ecstatic, jumping up in the air and happy that I'd been picked for another test. And he then kind of looked at me and he said, what's wrong? And I said, I actually don't want to be there. And it gave us an opportunity just to share and have some quiet time together and just to pray into the space. And, you know, how was I going to take this forward? Anyway, I headed down to Durban for the preparation for the third test 2 days later. I'd been in Kenton for 2 days, said goodbye to the family. And I think it was the 22nd, 23rd of December. And we began the preparations. And it was Christmas Day, and kind of phoned back to the family. And it was lovely Christmases we had in those days. I used to sit in a hotel room on my own. And I was kind of looking forward to a full-on family Christmas, but it wasn't to be that year. Anyway, we got into the match. England batted first and got 450-odd runs and then declared, and we went and batted in the first innings and we were bowled out for 180. I got a grand total of 3 or 4 runs. And it so happened that we had batted so badly that England made us follow on that same evening. So I thought, well, that's perfect. I can get my career over in one day. Went out to bat again. There were about 6 overs left in the day. And I kind of had, I missed virtually every ball. Just played and missed it. And managed to survive the evening and was on 2 not out overnight at the end of the day's play. Debs flew up that evening and she arrived at the hotel and she said, how are you feeling? So I said, well, you know that answer to that. Nothing's changed much over the last couple of weeks. And we just, again, just had some quiet time. And it was a really powerful quiet time. We spent a long time praying in the hotel room just to kind of ask God for whatever he wanted out of the next day. Just for me to try and enjoy this last day of cricket that I'm going to have. Just to kind of relax through it and just savor the moment. Anyway, I woke up the next morning feeling a lot calmer than I'd ever felt in my life in preparation to go out to bat for my country, because there was always intense pressure in that space. And I went out to bat on 2 not out, following on in a game about to lose it. And Andrew Caddick was a bowler, big, tall Englishman who had had a great series so far. He'd picked up lots of wickets. And I'll never forget the third ball that he bowled to me. I played a back foot drive and I punched it through the covers for 4 runs. The first time I'd hit the middle of the bat in 2 months. And a shot that I'd never played in my life, a back foot drive. Never ever played that shot in my whole career, a back foot drive. And I hit this for 4 and I looked at my bat and I saw the kind of red mark in the middle of the bat. It was fairly distinctive to see because there were no other red marks near the middle of the bat. And I kind of carried on batting. And, you know, you've got to understand the context because people often talk in the world of sport. You cannot walk onto a sports field and make performances without confidence. You know that word confidence gets bandied around a lot in sport. You've got to have confidence if you're going to be a successful sportsman. Well, I had 0 confidence. I couldn't wait to get off that field. I couldn't wait to get out. And I just kept batting, and 2 or 3 overs later, I hit another cover drive and one of my favorite shots and went to the boundary for 4. Suddenly, I'm on 20 not out. I hadn't got to 20 in 2 months. This is a weird feeling. This is new space for me. And I just kept batting and kept batting, and Andrew Flintoff bowled me a ball, and a very successful bowler for England at the time, and I went back to it, and it hit the top edge of the bat. And I saw this ball loop up, and I thought, well, I'm going to get caught out by the keeper. And I could see him running backwards and running backwards, and he dived and didn't get to the ball. and I survived. Ran two runs and I'm on 22 not out and I kept batting. Three or four balls later, I went and played that back foot drive and I nick one past third slip and it goes for four to the boundary. Now I'm on 28, 29 not out. And I just keep batting and this is the most bizarre experience I'm having. Anyway, I keep batting and I just can't get out. And get to lunchtime and I'm on kind of 46, 47 not out. Go back after lunch and I get to 60, 70 not out. And I keep batting through the day. Get to tea time, I'm on 90 not out. Get to the end of the day and I'm on 120 not out. And I remember saying to myself at the end of that day, there's something happening here and I need to... I need to take note of it. And I remember saying to myself, well, if there is something happening, where's it going to go? I've now got 120 not out, probably saved my career, but where is this going to go? Remember, we still got 2 days left in the test match. And woke up the next morning and it rained for the first kind of half of the day. And I went out to bat and I batted through that day. And then woke up the next morning and we're kind of getting to a stage where we're starting to save the test match, but we still need to bat for probably another 3 or 4 hours. And I go out and bat in the last day and I bat for another 3 or 4 hours. We save the test match and I end up on 275. So a couple of things happen. One, I saved my career. I end up going to play for the Proteas for another 5 years, another 40 test matches. I play for South Africa. So I saved my career. We saved the test match, which we were about to get a serious beating out of. Drew it and then won the next test match to win the series. And those things that happened to me on that day with zero confidence gave me the biggest wake-up call I've ever had in my life. But I think more importantly, what it made me kind of really grasp and understand as I kind of began my new spiritual journey was the realness of God. For me, I'd had my first experience of the realness of God in my life. And if that wasn't a wake-up call for me, none would be. But I think the important thing for me was to kind of feel that realness that he was absolutely present in my career at that time, visibly and consciously present. He was there because I wasn't. I was absolutely nowhere. But the only way that I could kind of give you the understanding of how I was able to get through that was when I did wake up that morning on that first day when I was two not out, or that second day, and went out to go play in that game. That time that I'd had with Debs in kind of preparing for that, and that prayer time that we'd had was just to relinquish your power. You've got no power tomorrow. Relinquish it. God has got your back. He's got this one. And it was a very weird feeling to go through that because as a professional sportsman with kind of the tools of my trade that I had, I felt that I could have control of it. But I realized how little control I've got over it. And I realized that through that relinquishment and that just giving of that moment and giving of that time, in that moment in my career, which was my experience of really finding out the true identity and realness of God in my life, I was able to kind of experience nothing that I would ever have had if it was my power running through that situation. So that for me was kind of the wake-up call to say to myself, you know, we go through this life thinking that we've got it, and I really did, thinking that I had it all mapped out. And in my moment of career weakness, I turned to God and he delivered. I wanted to share with you out of a book that I've read, which is a kind of for me, I'm reading it a second time now. I've just finished it and I'm picking it up and reading it again. It's a book written by a guy by the name of John Ortberg. I'm sure many of you would have heard of. And the book is titled Faith and Doubt. And I wanted to just take a paragraph out of this book, which has been incredibly powerful to me. I read it over and over again. Because as I kind of question the realness of God in all our lives, this really stands out for me. And it goes like this: evidence alone cannot clearly indicate that God does or does not exist. However, we must choose whether we will seek him. Not to choose is its own choice. Your wager began the moment you were born. You were launched. You will bet your life one way or the other. God either exists or he does not. Heads or tails, no third option. If God does not exist, we lose a life devoted to seeking, to love, to live generously, to speak truth, and to do justice. But if God does exist and we choose not to follow him, we lose everything. For me, a very powerful realization in terms of where I've decided to kind of rest my life on, into the realness and understanding that God lives kind of fully inside of me. So I wanted to kind of just thank you for the opportunity to share that story with you. I've been on this new spiritual journey, as I said, for 15 years. And every day I wake up kind of humbling myself and relinquishing myself to this everyday realization that it's actually not about me. And that I can get through these days giving my best and giving everything I've got with kind of God at the center of every decision and every choice that I make. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary. What a powerful testimony just of God's faithfulness. And I think for all of us, we need to do like David. You know, David said, I feed on God's faithfulness. You know, the ability to understand that even when we are unfaithful, God remains faithful. God is the only consistent in our lives. Where we can say, God, when I wake up and when I go to bed at night, you are the same. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Will you agree? Amen. So I want us, just before we're going to just worship and pray for each other, I want us to do something practically that I felt in my heart, is that we must share with each other how God has been faithful in your life. Just one thing. Part of your testimony, because Revelation says that we overcome by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of our testimony. There's such a powerful thing when we share of God's faithfulness. You know, the devil sometimes wants to remind us, and the world wants to remind us and tell us, hey, God doesn't exist, or he's always accusing us of God's faithfulness. And that's, I think, part of Satan's plan is to make us question the character of God, the goodness of God. And if we can get that, then, you know, it's so easy for us to get offended with God, or to start to doubt, or you know, just say, God, where are you? I remember even when I grew up, you know, many times I said, when things went bad, I said, God, where are you? Pointing the finger and say, Lord, you don't exist and you don't really care. And I just think God just probably sat there with a smile and say, hey, I love you. You know, I love you. So quickly, won't you just, if you have a minute, just quickly share. I think we have a minute. But share with somebody next to you just one thing that you can tell somebody next to you of God's faithfulness. And then we're going to pray for each other. Won't you just groups of two or three as the band come up, the worship team. And then we're going to pray for each other.
document where it's like looking.